Someone actually asked how to deal with evil-minded, money-oriented parents.
There's no such thing as evil. That was like a Christian concept, which, you know, I really rejected so heavily. Because, you know, the fact that someone is evil through and through. In other words, they've got no redeeming qualities in them. Now, for people who are Theravada through and through, they may sort of argue with me, but that idea that everyone has Buddha nature, everyone has a seed of goodness inside them, no matter who they are. Of course, that's, you know, what I don't just believe in, you experience that. People who have been just so bad and hopeless, have had sort of done murders and rapes, to see such people find another part of themselves, a part they can be proud of, a part they can respect, a part they can work on to grow into much better human beings. It's not just evil-minded. We don't believe in evil, we believe in delusion. They're not seeing things correctly. So, first of all, if that's your parents, there's no way that children can teach their parents. I tried that once with my mother, and she was interested, but there's no way I could teach her. And the reason was because that psychology between, especially a mother, she brought you into this world. You know, she taught you the first things of life. The psychology just doesn't work. A child can't be the teacher of a parent. So what we do is I get somebody else to teach my mum. And surely it works really easily, but I just cannot do it. There was a story of the Buddha's chief monk, Sariputta, who was the wisest monk next to the Buddha. And he was always trying to teach his mother. And it was, according to the old story, that he was 80 years of old, just before he passed away. He went to see his mother one last time. His mother must have been really old. And his mother said, "Haven't you got a better job yet? You lazy, good for nothing." She scolded. And this was the wisest monk could not teach his own mother. Other people could, but not him. That's a psychology. So don't ever try to teach your parents. Instead, use the roundabout sneaky method. Which means to find out somebody your parents like and respect. And then also make those teachings easy for them. So, you know, in their own language, in their own style. So you may be really impressed with Ajahn Brahm. But number one, your parents can't speak English. And they're Mahayanas, and they're not Theravadas. So find somebody who's a really inspiring Mahayana teacher speaking in Cantonese, and then leave some books, or even better, recordings, so they can just push it on, push a button and listen to it, laying in their bed, whatever they're doing, to make it convenient for your parents. And that way, you can actually teach your parents in that roundabout way. And one of the things you teach them is, you know, just that, well, what's the purpose of money? You know, that I remember the story of, which Ajahn Chah taught me once. He said, you know, one day he made a prediction, but it's only like a metaphor. He said, one day the world will run out of metal to make coins. And we'll run out of paper to make notes. So we have to get another type of currency. And he said one day, instead of using paper and metal, we'll use pellets of chicken shit. You know, little pellets, and that'll be our currency. Because it's only the value people give it. So everyone will be going around with a pocket full of chicken poo. And they will be very, very proud how much chicken poo they have in the bank. And the IMF will become the International Manure Fund. And we're saying, "Oh, I'm much better than you. I've got more chicken shit than you have." And he went on like this because, you know, there is, what is metal anyway. It just comes from the earth, and we, you know, that's all it is. Paper is just the value we give it. Even like, you know, cryptocurrencies. You know, you don't actually see it. It's just, you know, a fantasy which is in your computer. So anyway, that should have crypto shit. Currency. Not Bitcoin, but exactly. Shitcoin, the new cryptocurrency.
Well, since you mentioned about cryptocurrency, I do have a question on that. Human intelligence has built the world beyond its physical form, such as the currency system. Bill Gates thinks that the cryptocurrency are using a rare technology that has caused death in a fairly direct way. What's your feel on that?
Because I do look at BBC News and the ABC News, I have to be able to answer questions like that, to keep a little bit up to date. And he was saying that it's because it makes it easier to buy drugs, to actually launder money, and even actually to get sort of weapons. And it's because, you know, it is a way of transferring money basically without any regulations. And again, it's, you know, with drugs or weapons or guns, it's, they do kill people. But why do people take those drugs? And, you know, we all know that it doesn't matter how many laws and regulations we have, those things still manage to get through customs, still become easily available. You know, and when I was teaching in prisons, people were saying they may have got into that prison because of a drug crime. There's more drugs available inside jail than there was outside. And that was really shocking. And when, of course, you go to a place like Singapore where they have the death penalty, you know, for people who carry drugs. There's still this huge amounts of drugs easily available within that country, even though there's a death penalty which should be a deterrent. And I don't know why people still think deterrents work. Because even I remember such a long time ago, there was a sociologist in UK who, when there was hangings, a death penalty for even just what today will be minor crimes. And he did an interview about all the people who were about to be hung, many of them, big sample, and how many of them had actually witnessed a hanging, because hangings were public. Anyone could go and see it. But I think it was about 60 or 70% of the people who were about to be hung had witnessed. So much for deterrent value. So instead, there's something I was talking with Gerald about, but because I live in Australia, there was another means, another way, which is a fascinating path to follow, and it was with cigarettes. And the Australian way of dealing with, you know, tobacco, which is also, it's a dangerous drug. It kills people, and well, the way they dealt with it was not making it illegal, not putting people in jail for selling tobacco, but what they did was actually to use the negative marketing. First of all, plain packaging. So there wasn't, like you have in many countries like Hong Kong, really gross images on the outside of the packet of ghosts and skulls and just damaged organs of the human body. That didn't work as well as just plain packaging with hardly any information on the outside at all. And number two, mandatory, the worst color in the world, which was baby poo brown. The colour of the poo which comes out of a baby in the first weeks of the life. The most disgusting colour. And so they were selling it in baby poo brown, and they were making sure that it wasn't cool, it wasn't regarded as fashionable. That message got out, it wasn't an in-cool thing to do. Because the people who started to get into the tobacco was again the young people. And they did it because it's fashionable. It's cool. You're not a real guy unless you smoke. So because of that, they reduce the amount of people taking cigarettes enormously. So sometimes with the drugs, which is what Bill Gates was referring to, or guns or whatever, to make it not cool to carry a gun, to make it not cool to take drugs, to make it just really so kids feel you're an idiot to do such things. Because legalizing, making it illegal, you just make it more attractive. There's more money to be made for smugglers and crime. That one doesn't work. I've been seeing many, 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 many times. You have to think outside the box. When old things don't work, you try something new. And there's evidence there. You've got the Australian experience with tobacco. It's reduced it enormously. So that's where it's not cryptocurrencies which is causing death. It is just the attractiveness which we have for such drugs or alcohol or not alcohol. I'm talking about for drugs or smokes.
Then that gives me an idea for the next question. If you're the Donald Trump,
yes.
How would you handle the current gun control situation?
Okay. I did. Somebody sent me this a beautiful little interview with one of the governors in the United States who really supports guns, and it was very, very funny. But it was also just telling him that, again. I'm not praising Australia because they do a lot of stupid things, like with their refugees, which is against human rights. But it was what they did with gun control. They actually, even recently, every year they have a gun amnesty. And even they're buying back those guns and destroying them. And just, they did that because there was a huge massacre in a place called Port Arthur. Is the biggest number of civilian deaths in Australia for a long time. And after that massacre, that they were having, I think, about an average one massacre, more than four people killed by guns. That was called like a massacre. And every year after that, it stopped. They confiscated the guns. And they, instead of actually just making it was illegal, but they could have an amnesty, you can give in your guns, even actually you can get some money back for them. And so many people gave up their guns. And now there's, it's very, very, very rare to see a gun in Australia. Maybe farmers have them, to protect their sheep or whatever. But others do not. So that gun control works. The evidence is there. And it's not just that people use other instruments like knives to kill. Just if the easiest way of killing another human being with a gun, because you're at a distance, you feel safer. If I have a gun here and I shoot you, then I have to get that close with a knife. So it is obvious psychology that it's easier. More people will be killed, easy availability of guns, than even with knives.
And if you happen to see one of the high school kids dying from the gun, imagine that high school massacre incident,
yeah.
What would be the best thing you can say to that person who is dying?
Is dying, that first of all, just relax. This was one case where I'd probably lie. I said, oh, that's not very bad, you'll be okay. I do that because that's what I learned from a GP when I was a school teacher. I was teaching physics at school. That was the main subject I was teaching. And all the other students, we had very good lectures on child psychology and obviously the physics and sociology and stuff like that. But then, one of the students suggested, sooner or later, some kid is going to put like a piece of metal in the electric socket. Or in the chemistry lab, they're going to be playing around and they'll tip over some acid, concentrate acid over themselves. It's a very dangerous environment in a laboratory. So if that happens, what do? We want to have an afternoon with a GP who teaches us basic first aid. And this old GP came, he'd been in the profession for years, a very wise fellow. And he said, if ever you see, and one of the things he did, he had a big white sheet of paper, of white cloth, and he took a little thimbleful of blood, and he threw it at the piece of the big sheet of white cloth, and the blood went everywhere. And he said, this is just a small amount, like a thimbleful of blood, but when it spreads over a cloth, you can overreact and say, wow, look at all that blood, the person's dying. But it's only a small amount. Sometimes first responders overreact. And this is what the doctor said. The doctor, he was very open and sometimes gory about it. If you see someone's arm just separated from their body, you say, oh, that's nothing, we can put that back together again. Because it's the shock, he told us, which kills most people. And I think when you get shocked, then what happens is the blood vessels, they dilate. And so the blood pressure goes down, and then that causes cardiac arrest, that you die. So he said that's one really important time. You see someone who's badly injured after a car crash, then it's a lie. So that you keep them alive. Oh, that's nothing, you'll be fine. To reassure us. So the last thing I'd say, look at that, you're dying! You kill it that way.
Then, since you have more experience in those palliative care, the hospital area, there's a question on, is it alright? This person is asking whether it's okay to apply Buddhist teaching in a non-Buddhist environment to share with those palliative care patients.
Yeah, you can just take the common sense approach to understand what happens when a person dies. They want to be reassured. Love, compassion, that has no religion. And just to be kind to a person. They're dying, what takes away a lot of pain is just stroking them, just holding their hand. Being with them in the last few moments. But what is really terrible is don't go around, oh, it's so terrible to see you die. Don't die on me like that. A person dying needs a bit of privacy. And if you are emotional, that's one more problem they have to deal with. They're already dealing with their own passing away. That's why it's happened many times. I'm sure you've noticed this as well. You're standing, next to the bedside, talking, saying, oh, stay with me, don't die, it'll be terrible when you die, whatever it is. And then you're staying there for such a time, and then you decide, well, you have to go and get something to eat, just for 5 minutes, and as soon as you walk out of the room, that's when they die. They're waiting for you to go. Because dying is a very private thing. Person, you need space. To do it in your own way, without worrying about all these other people harassing you at that time. So that's another thing to do. Give them permission to die. Say, look, you've got to die. We'll give you our permission. Don't worry about us. You've been a great father, a great mother. We love you so much, but you're at the end of the life now. Now every other hour you stay alive is more torture for you, more pain for you. And now we don't want you to be in pain. You're going to die anyway soon. So let go and just go with it. So that's really important. I don't know if this happens in Hong Kong. There's a big problem in Malaysia that there were some people, you know, they were Buddhist, and then one of their children or grandchildren was one of these evangelical Christians. And they thought if their father or their uncle was a Buddhist and they stay as a Buddhist, they're going to go to hell. They're going to suffer because Christianity is the only religion, and not just all types of Christianity, just my Christianity. So with the best will in the world, they go to the bedside with their pastor, with all their friends, and say, Daddy, Daddy, you must convert to Christianity. And they're all around, they're harassing you for hour after hour. Does that happen in Hong Kong sometimes? I found the solution. And this is the solution. I remember telling this to Dr. Kesavi Dharmananda. He laughed his head off and then told everybody else. And I said, look, those evangelicals are just so stubborn. They will not leave you alone until you convert. So I said to them, well, simple. You're by the bedside there, they're harassing you, and you say, okay, I convert. Become a Christian. And they go, hallelujah, hallelujah, and then they'll leave the room. As soon as they're out the door, convert back, put down the side of the side. You can convert one way, you can convert back again. That's the only way to get rid of that.
Have you been to any party before the person passed away? I think it's getting more and more common of people, you know, the dying people care. It could be hosting a party for to celebrate the last moments of life.
The last moments of life. It's not so much a party, but there was this one gentleman who I think it's a very interesting idea. He had his funeral before he died. He was going to die in a few days. So, you know, he got all his friends together, and they would come in and said, do come to a funeral service. And got the priest there as well, and to do all the chanting and the last rites and everything else, and all the what they call the eulogies. Because he wanted to find out what people said about him. You know, it's really awful, isn't it? I've been to so many of those funerals. We say, oh, what a wonderful person he was, and how kind he was. And that poor person's not there to hear it. So he said, I want to hear this, what people thought of me. I'm going to die in a couple of days. And also, he could also check out who actually came to the funeral and still have time to change his will. That's called thinking outside the box. Literally, thinking outside the casket.
I quite like this idea.
Yeah.
I know before the person dies.
Yeah.